You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster. Do you wake up on Sunday morning itching to open up the newspaper and dig into the crossword puzzle? You're not alone.
Over the past century, crossword puzzles have been enjoyed by millions of people, including dignitaries like Queen Elizabeth and even fictional characters like Christopher Robin.
What's so appealing about these brain teasers? Ellen Connor is a comedy writer and a quizmaster who chronicles the rich and storied history of crossword puzzles in his new book, The Crossword Century, 100 Years of Witty Wordplay, Ingenious Puzzles, and Linguistic Mischief. Ellen, welcome to Central Time.
Hello, thank you so much for having me.
Well, the crossword puzzle turned 100 last year. Take us back to the beginning. How was it born?
It was born in a bit of a panic, if the truth be told. There was the newspaper, the New York World, had a section called called Fun, which was their section full of puzzles. And the chap who populated these pages with puzzles was called Arthur Wynn, who'd wanted actually to be a kind of Pulitzer-winning journalist, but such was his fate, he ended up in charge of the puzzles. And one Christmas, he was told there was going to be twice as much fun as normal. And he only knew so many puzzles and had to fill up his pages. And rather than leave some blank space and get fired, he thought he'd better invent a new kind of challenge to join the word searches and things that he had. So he came up with this strange diamond shape that he called a word cross, and a set of what he called definitions of words to put in there. And little did he know that we would still be talking about what he did 100 years later.
Well, and it took a while to catch on, didn't it?
It did. It was his puzzle had its fans in the New York World, but it really took until America of the 20s embraced every fad going for the crossword to really explode. So in 1925, Mr. Simon and Mr. Schuster, of Simon and Schuster, decided that they needed some books to publish. They had a publishing company, but no actual books. They put out a collection of crossword puzzles. It had changed its name from Word Cross to Crossword by then. And they were lucky to be coming just as the Mahjong craze was dying out, and America needed something else to roar about in the 20s. The crossword appeared and went absolutely stellar in the year of 1925, to the extent that, you know, perfectly sensible women could turn up to boutiques and ask to be decked out in robes that would make them look like a crossword puzzle, or buy little earrings with black and white checkered squares on them.
Well, and as I understand it, the crossword puzzle was more popular in the United States rather than Britain. Why was there such a difference in the appeal?
I think Americans are more up for fun, is one explanation. The other thing is that when the kind of the British establishment saw that the crossword was so big in America, they were a bit suspicious, as British people sometimes are, of Americans who are enjoying themselves. And the newspapers in particular in Britain were very hostile to the crossword. My theory is that they didn't like the fact that they didn't like the idea of people spending money on books of puzzles rather than on newspapers. And so the newspapers of the United Kingdom ran essentially a campaign against crosswords, saying we can't let these things come over here because working men are doing these silly puzzles when they should be, you know, they should be benefiting their employers, and mothers are letting their children go hungry because they've become addicted to these crazy puzzles. But, you know, as with any of these things that become popular, the newspapers will happily kind of hypocritically do a complete U-turn and say, well, maybe these things aren't so bad after all. I mean, even the New York Times was initially very sceptical about crosswords and considered them very lowbrow. And then they figured, well, people do kind of like them. Maybe we should have one.
Well, that's ironic, too. I mean, the New York Times Sunday puzzle is probably one of the most popular, at least here in the United States.
Yeah, the de facto puzzle, I think, of the New York Times Sunday one.
Yeah.
I suppose what they did was they made it a little better. You know, this first puzzle that was created in 1913 was not a very good one. The clues weren't very good. The same answer was in there twice. It was quite confusing to find your way around. You didn't really know where to write the answers in. But the New York Times, they actually recruited the woman that used to be the fact checker on the New York World. And she'd spent, Margaret Petherbridge, her name was, she became mm-hmm. Margaret Farrar. She'd spent a long time kind of looking with a very close eye at how the crossword works and established a lot of rules about word length and symmetry in the grid and fairness to the solver. And she made it a much more satisfying and edifying thing to do. And the sort of conventions that she established, I suppose, in the 20s and 30s, the ones that are still followed by crossword constructors to this day.
Yeah, let's talk about those just a little bit. If you could take us behind the scenes of what goes into creating these puzzles. They're not just, I mean, you look at a blank one on the page and it's almost a work of art, all these little designs and the grid and the symmetry on them. But it's actually a systematic thing, an official way to build the puzzle. Why don't you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yeah, so what Margaret Petherbridge realized was that if you have, for example, if you have a grid where various sections of that shape are isolated from each other, that's nice for the constructor because they can kind of put in whatever words they like, but it's less satisfying for the solver because it's harder to get that one answer that helps you get another answer. So there are sort of, I suppose there are almost architectural considerations like that she came up with, which I didn't really ever appreciate until I started trying to construct puzzles myself. And what I realized was it's very easy to start a puzzle that you think is amazing, and what you realize is every word you put in limits the words that can cross with it, and you end up with a corner where you have to use kind of the name of some town in Alaska that no one's heard of, or a piece of slang that hasn't been used for 50 years. And of course, a puzzle like that would never appear in the paper. So that experience made me realize the kind of the formal constraints that people have. But what Margaret Petherbridge was also concerned about, I suppose, was the tone, was the language, and the sort of the world of words that you're asking the solver to enter into. So if your listeners will forgive me for saying the word urine is a word that crossword constructors would love to be able to use, because there aren't that many five-letter words that begin with U and it has these lovely vowels that it would mean that it would fit into a grid very readily. But Margaret Petherbridge's advice to constructors, and which is followed to the Times to this day, is do people really want to be writing that word into their puzzle? The first thing in the morning is the first thing they do in their day with their coffee. Probably not.
Yeah, well, and that's it makes you wonder how often five-letter words starting with U come up in the crossword puzzle. And as I understand it, she also established a rule of no two-letter words.
Yeah, and what that I think has helped out with is it means that we don't always see the same two-letter words, because if you were to allow these two-letter words in a grid, you would probably just keep getting the same ones coming up again and mm-hmm. DO, for example. And sure, there are a bunch of ways you could clue that as the verb to do, or you could use the musical note as in do re mi. But solvers would kind of they get bored if they see the same words coming up time and time again. So it's another way in which the more life becomes difficult for the constructor, the more satisfying it is for the solver.
And there are a number of tricks that puzzle constructors like to play on us innocent victims here to make it extra tricky and kind of a brain teaser. Can you tell us a little bit, for example, what a Nina is?
Well, I love Ninas when I spot them, and that's the thing, you don't always spot them. Nina is a slang term used by some of the creators of puzzles to refer to a message or a kind of theme in a grid that isn't announced. So sometimes you can solve a puzzle and get to the end and think you've done everything that there is to do, and then notice, oh, there's actually, all these words have something in common, or there's an extra message going up the diagonal of the grid. And I suppose the sort of geniuses with the warped minds who are very good at coming up with these puzzles, they relish a challenge, and so sometimes they add these challenges onto themselves, even if it's just to sneak a message saying happy birthday to their kid or something that's there in the but most silvers won't make it. But they're always lovely if you spot them. They're like a little extra treat, I suppose.
Mm-hmm. We're talking with Alan Connor. He's the author of The Crossword Century, 100 Years of Witty Wordplay, Ingenious Puzzles, and Linguistic Mischief. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Cynthia Schuster.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're talking with Alan Connor about the rich history and wide appeal of the crossword puzzle.
And we invite you to join the conversation. What do you love about crosswords? What leaves you pulling your hair out on a Sunday morning? Let us know at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. Alan, just before the break, we were talking about some of the tricks that puzzle creators play. Tell us a little bit, though, about just the inherent challenge of playing a game with the English language. I mean, the language itself can be tricky.
It can. I think the English language, I think, is one of the hardest ones for non-native speakers to learn, because we have so many words for one given thing, because English has kind of sucked up bits of Greek and bits of Latin, and there are all these different words sort of competing with each other to describe one thing. And the other effect of that sort of hodgepodge of the English language is that one word can mean lots of different things. So what makes that thing that makes it very difficult to learn means that English is, I think, very good for wordplay and for kind of jokes and for being silly with language. So The kind of clues that I really like in American puzzles are those ones that that end with a question mark. And there's a couple I'm really fond of that have to do with traffic. So there's one I read, fits on a hard drive. And the answer to that is road rage. What I like about that is you've thought of fits as a verb, and it's a mm-hmm. noun, and you've thought of a hard drive as being something to do with computers, and in fact it's a difficult period of driving a car. Another one like that I've enjoyed is dangers for the over 70 crowd, and you think of seniors falling over or whatever, but the answer there is radar traps. And so I suppose what crossword constructors do is they look at that ambiguity that's there in the English language, and they use it to make you smile. What they want to do, I suppose, is that they want to confuse you, but they want you to then finally get it once you've got some of the letters and you see what the answer is. And for me, when the penny drops and you see how a clue like that works, it's like being told a joke. Your brain sort of hops from one place to another, and you get a little lift and a little smile, and the kind of pleasure that you don't really get from a Sudoku.
Yeah, I think that's why I struggle. I'm so literal that when I see a clue like that, I never think of the other punchline.
That's what they're doing. Yeah,
I get more of a kick of reading the answer key the next day, when it comes in the newspaper. Let's take a call from Sarah in Wausau. She's on the line. Hi, Sarah.
Hi. I never really was a fan of crossword puzzles, simply because I just didn't give myself the time to do it. But I value them as a teacher, and I'm teaching elementary grades. And let's say I'm teaching a unit on erosion or rocks. As a review, I can go on the computer and go on to programs like PuzzleMaker.com, I think it is. I'm not at my computer right now. But there are all these free websites out there that can make crossword puzzles. And you can just type in the words that you want in there, and you can throw some extra words, too, for fun. And within seconds, you'll have a crossword puzzle that you can use and get kids used to doing that kind of thing. So it's a fun tool to use, and I really enjoy them. They're simple, but they're effective.
Thanks, Sarah. That's great. So using crossword puzzles as a learning tool, but also has a side effect of introducing young people to crosswords pretty early. What do you think about that, Alan?
I can kind of picture those kids having that that pleasure that you get of you look at a clue and you don't know what the answer is, but then you start with some of the easier ones. Those letters are there, and there's something very satisfying about filling up that grid. I think that's why some people prefer a pencil, because it feels like a real achievement sometimes to fill each of those squares with a letter and kind of build it all together like that. But I can also sympathize with the thing about having to devote the time to a puzzle because, they do take a while. You do sort of have to kind of put other things to one side. But what I sometimes find is that if there's something that's troubling me, I can go off and do a crossword puzzle, and it's almost like rebooting my brain. You know, I go off and do something completely abstract, and when I kind of come back up for air and go back out into the real world, the problems that have been troubling me sometimes seem easier to do.
And I know you delved into this just a little bit in your book, but crossword puzzles and activities like that are credited for things like staving off dementia. And your point there just reminded me of that. But did you find any truth to that belief?
Sadly, I didn't. You know, I was hoping it might be true, because sometimes people say, you know, why do you do these? You know, why are you hooked on these silly puzzles? Isn't it a waste of time? And it would be nice to say, oh, well, you know, I'm kind of insulating my brain against Alzheimer's. You know, like a lot of these medical stories that you read in the newspapers, there doesn't seem to be any actual research that backs that up. But what the psychological researchers do think is that if you have an activity that you do regularly, and if you do it socially, if you're calling out the clues to other people, and you're kind of putting your brains together and making your brain work in a way that it wouldn't normally work, then that does keep you ticking over. So that's my advice, is A, keep doing them, because that social activity is important, but B, you know, if you're enjoying doing it, that's reason enough in itself. You know, the fun is the reason.
Speaking of advice, I was hoping you could take us through some tips you have for actually doing well with crossword puzzles and even getting faster at them. Because, I mean, there are people out there who take crossword puzzles so seriously, competing in national competitions. And there was a 2006 documentary about that called Wordplay. But you have a rudimentary toolkit for solving crossword puzzles. What's in it? Tell us about the toolkit.
Well, it was derived from some of the advice of the sort of people you see in that amazing documentary, Wordplay. So for them, because speed is everything, a lot of what they advise is purely down to literally just shaving seconds off your solve. So these kind of pro solvers will write a lowercase a rather than an uppercase one, because it shaves some fractions off their time. But one thing I found especially interesting about that documentary is it's not something I've tried yet myself, is that the competitors have all got headphones on as they're filling in their puzzles in this crossword tournament. And what's playing in their headphones is, it sounds like white noise. It's actually the amplified sound of one of the lobbies that United Nations building. So this kind of blocks out the outside world to them and lets them enter the zone of the puzzle. My other tip is sometimes start from the end, because there's a theory that the constructors may have written the clues in order, you know, from mm-hmm. one across onwards. And so the ones that they'll have written last, they might have been a bit more tired and a bit less fiendish. You may have better success from starting in the southeast corner, as it were, and building it up from there.
Oh, I hadn't thought of that. Yeah, and by the time they get there, their options are fewer in terms of constructing clever words, so you might get some easy clues there. And you also said to have someone tell a joke before solving the puzzle. What's that going to do for us?
That was one of the odd things that I found when I was looking into the dementia kind of theory. Was you get these strange pieces of research that people have sometimes done, and one thing that came out of some academic research into humor and the way that the brain works is that people who have been told a joke 10 minutes beforehand perform better at crossword puzzles and are better at are faster at solving them and get more of the clues. And that seemed odd to me, which is why I made a note of it. But then the more I thought about it, the more I thought about this way in which, well, you know, jokes aren't that much unlike crossword puzzle clues sometimes. They ask your brain to go in one direction, and then suddenly there's this left turn there. And the whole thing adds up, but it's that element of surprise that you get in a joke and with a really good crossword clue, I think is why a joke is a kind of limbering up exercise for doing a crossword puzzle. Mm.
Well, if we want to study up and get better at solving these crossword puzzles, maybe have some more knowledge about the obscure facts that might be asked of us as we're filling them out, are there certain subject areas we should try to study up on, or should we study up on a little bit of everything? What's your approach to gaining that knowledge?
I think I would say read the newspaper. And the reason for that is that what the constructors of these puzzles have to do is they have to avoid being too clever themselves, because if they ask for something that that you only know about if you've got a kind of master's degree in astrophysics, well, the solvers are going to be understandably angry. They're going to write to the newspaper, and you're going to find that you're not getting commissioned to do any more puzzles. So what the constructors have to do, which is a very difficult thing to do, I think, is to have a sense of, you know, what does everybody know? You know, what will they have picked up on? Which bands are high frequency enough pop bands that I can fairly ask about them, and which of them are kind of fly by night people who might be forgotten even by the time this puzzle goes into print? And I think the newspaper is a natural home for the puzzle in that way, because if you're familiar with the kind of the geographical references in the newspaper and the historical figures and the new words that are coming in, like twerk or whatever, that weren't in the English language a year before, then you've probably got that toolkit that's necessary for the puzzle.
Well, Alan, thank you so much for joining us today.
No, thank you. I've had a wonderful time.
That was Alan Connor, quizmaster and author of The Crossword Century, 100 Years of Witty Wordplay, Ingenious Puzzles, and Linguistic Mischief.
I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster. The news is next here on Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.